Good afternoon, everyone. It's the Senate Committee on Health Care. Do I open a subcommittee with only two people here? Okay, so I'll open a subcommittee until we have a quorum. It is Monday, April 27th, as I said, the Health Care Committee, and I want to open up just briefly House Bill 2930A and have Representative Kenny Guy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and member of the committee. For the record, I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, State Rep for House District 46, parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland. Thank you for squeezing me in because I'm chairing another committee, so I'll be quick. House Bill 2930A requires hospitals grant independent admitting privileges and membership on medical staff with voting rights to nurse, midwife, nurse practitioners who are accepted to practice in their facilities. Nurse, midwife, nurse practitioners are advanced practice registered nurses, also known as CNMs, who specialize in providing counseling and care during preconception, pregnancy, childbirth, and the postpartum period. Certified nurse midwives deliver high-quality, cost-effective care. In 2013, nurse midwives delivered 17% of babies born in Oregon. Of those, 97% were born in the hospital setting. The bill does not force hospitals to use certified nurse midwives, but only refers to hospitals that choose to use them in their practice. Granting independent hospital admitting privileges to nurse midwives will allow them to provide consistent, seamless care to their patients. While there is always physician backup at the hospitals, this bill would end the practice of requiring a physician who has never met the birthing mother to admit her. OBGYN Duncan Nielsen, head of Women's Health Services at Legacy Emanuel Hospital, which along with OHSU has been granting admitting privileges to certified nurse midwives for years, was surprised to learn that some hospitals were not doing this. ACOG, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, has issued support for this at both the national and the state level. The American College of Nurse Midwives, the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems all support this bill after a few amendments. The bill will support Oregon's collaborative system of maternal care to foster optimal outcomes for Oregon moms and babies. I want to thank Certified Nurse Midwives Laura Jensen, who is here today, Elizabeth Cavanaugh, Happy Barnes, and Nancy McMorris for their tremendous work on this issue, to the House Healthcare Committee for passing it unanimously, to my colleague, Representative Kennemer, who could not be here today, who helped co-carry this on the House, where it received unanimous support as well. So open to any questions, but there are also people behind me that can answer more.
Question? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're going to keep this open because we have Representative Lively here, so I'm going to let him.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm going to keep that open and open a public hearing on HJM 6A.
HJM 6A urges Congress to take steps to ease the primary care physician's shortage in Oregon. There is no amendment, and there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is John Lively. I'm from House District 12, which is the city of Springfield. I bring to you today House Joint Memorial 6. I don't have to tell any of you that there's a shortage of providers and certainly a shortage of primary care providers in Oregon. And it's pretty extreme in the county of Lane, where I come from, where with the more people added to the rolls for insurance, we have less and less providers to do that. And unfortunately, the long-term trend is for fewer providers. And so there's multiple efforts going on to start addressing this. And unfortunately, of course, those efforts are several years down the road before they will result in more providers. But a key part of that is residency and being able to train more providers. And what we do know from residency is, I think the number is 80% of the doctors stay in practice in the community or the state in which they do the residency. And so Oregon is not unique, but we have a limited number of residencies. So what this joint memorial does, it just calls upon Congress to open up. So let me just get this. We urge Congress to remove the cap on primary care medical residency programs, to explore the creation of innovative community-based graduate medical education programs, and to implement stronger planning and oversight of the use of public funds for graduate medical education. Both important from the standpoint of the federal world, but also reinforces some of what we're trying to do in this state, because there are efforts here in this state also to make some investments in residency, but obviously the federal government plays the critical role. And we have been in contact with Representative DeFazio and others, and they certainly understand and appreciate it, and believe anything we can do kind of jointly to express the concern about this and raise the awareness will help in their understanding. So I urge your support.
Thank you. Question?
Yeah. Well, if I may, just Madam Chair, as one of the other chief sponsors, as are Senator Cruz and Senator Knope on this bill, and I'd urge the other two members of this committee to join the party. I'm happy to go sit over there, but I would just say that for those of you who don't understand the intricacies of how we pay for graduate medical education in this country, it's Byzantine is a polite word, and arbitrary is equally accurate, and we have to change that system. We've been working hard to do that at multiple levels for a long time. And in particular, I'll give you one really clear example. There's a cap on how many residents you can have, period, at a hospital, and it has to do with how many residents you have at that hospital 3 years after starting a program. Somewhere back in the dark ages, i.e. the 1960s or 70s, St. Charles.
That's not dark ages.
Okay. Well, dark ages for how we did graduate medical education. Before family medicine, I think, was even a board-certified specialty, St. Charles had a residency in something. I don't even know what. It might have been internal medicine, and they had exactly one resident at the end of 3 years, and that means that St. Charles is currently capped, total, period, at one resident, which means they can't start a residency program. It's a perfect place to locate a family medicine residency or psychiatry residency, both of which are critical for this state. The Affordable Care Act opened up some new, reallocated some slots, but Oregon didn't get any of those slots. And for primary care, with this nation facing a huge healthcare workforce shortage, it needs to change. And we need to work on multiple mechanisms. I'm working on some other ones with Representative Lively. But this is a great bill, and I urge everybody's support.
Madam Chair, I'd say a message to Congress is good, but maybe a message to the AMA might help as well.
Well, the AMA has been working on this for some time, Senator. I've been in Washington lobbying on this bill through the American Academy of Family Physicians and the AMA probably half a dozen times personally, in the offices of most of the members of our congressional delegation. So I've been there. In fact, this year I'm missing it because I'm here. But
any other questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Robin, is it Dribelbus? Was I even close?
Dribelbus.
Okay.
She wasn't close then.
Yes, I was.
But she tried.
So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I thank you very much for allowing me to speak on behalf of HJM 6. My name is Dr. Robin Dribelbus. I'm a family physician, many years in McMinnville, but now I work in large part with the College of Osteopathic Medicine in the Pacific down in Lebanon, Oregon, the Osteopathic Medical School, the other medical school in Oregon. Most of what I was going to say has already been said.
I apologize.
No, not at all. But just for clarification purposes and definitions, so that members of the audience as well as all of you fully understand the sort of spectrum of medical education. So somebody decides that they want to be a doctor, they apply to medical school, they're accepted, and that process of medical school training is 4 years long. And at the end of that 4 years, they graduate. And they're actually called doctor. But it's at that point that they figure out what they want to do with the rest of their life and their career and decide to be a family physician or an internal medicine physician or a dermatologist or whatever specialty speaks to them. That process, that next level of medical education on the spectrum is called graduate medical education, often known as residency. And so it's the residency portion that we're speaking of. Now, back in 1997, which is when the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 came about, it was a federal congressional decision that at that point in time, 1997, all residency that was supported and paid for by Medicare dollars would be capped at that current level. But in roundabout 2006, using numbers from 2002, the American Association of Medical Colleges, AAMC, decided that looking forward, that we were going to need more physicians to take care of the populace of the United States, with people aging into Medicare, as well as physicians retiring from the process. And so they decided that they were going to sort of put a number on the table, and from 2002 levels of medical school graduates, they wanted to increase that number by 30% in the next 15 years. So we're looking at that in 2017, and actually it's this year that we're going to hit that number. And in large part, osteopathic medical schools have come to the table and been a large part of that. So medical school graduates have increased by 30% over those 2002 numbers, but that 1997 Balanced Budget Act has remained capped, which means that no more residents can be trained over those numbers. Now, I brought some numbers based on the 2015 match of, so when medical students graduate and they decide where what they want to do their residency in and where they want to go, they do a match, which is basically a process where the hospital says that they want that particular resident, and the resident or the medical student says that they want to go there. That process is called the match. And that match process had in it this year over 41,000 applicants for 30,000 residency spots, which means that there is a glaring deficit of 11,000 positions, that those residents that or those medical students who have graduated from medical school are going to go in, not be able to go to that next level of their medical education, which is tragic looking at and knowing what the debt load is for these people. This is a way to say that and tell Congress that this is an important issue that needs to be solved, and it has to be solved at the federal level. And so HJM 6, though in many ways symbolic, is an important way that we can show Congress that this is not a partisan issue at all. And in fact, HJM 6 was passed unanimously on the House side, 59-0. So I think that we as a state can declare that residency training is important to the process of not only taking care of our state, but taking care of the populace of the United States.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Comments? All right.
I would just to follow up on what you were saying, I would point out that HCM SIS talks specifically about primary care.
True.
Historically, when hospitals have had open slots, they've chosen to fund programs or support programs in higher-paying specialties, specialties with higher levels of reimbursement, subspecialties like otolaryngology or orthopedic surgery. We need those folks, but not as much as we need primary care doctors. And we have more students, especially now that Northwest is here and up and running at full speed, which is terrific from my perspective. We have more students who want to train in family medicine and stay in Oregon for residency than we have slots in the state to take them every year by a long shot. And we should be able to keep every single one of those if we want to. And it's a problem. And I'm really excited about this bill.
Thank you.
May I make one last comment? That is very true. And Comp Northwest is actually graduating our first class of 100 medical students that will soon be physicians, June 5th. And we matched 100% of those to residency slots in the 2015 match. 73% chose to go into primary care. And osteopathic medicine as a profession, in large part, has tended to go into primary care as a specialty choice. And we've worked very, very closely, actually, with Congressman DeFazio's office in sort of taking a leadership role on this issue and working to draft legislation specifically identifying primary care as the way to allocate those new residency slots.
That's great. How many of those residencies are in Oregon from Comp Northwest?
I don't know that number, but I know that many of them chose to go to the Samaritan program in Corvallis. Okay. We filled the internal medicine residency down there with our graduates. That's 9 position. Over half of the residents in family medicine, though there's it's 9 this year, 5 of them went to Comp Northwest students. For family medicine, as well as some of the other specialties. And a number of them actually chose to go into OHSU as well as Legacy in the state. So I would say if I had to put a number on it, somewhere around 30.
30? Mm-hmm. Out of how many?
100.
Yeah. I'd like more to stay in Oregon, but...
So would we need the slots.
We need exactly. To,
yeah,
we need the slots.
That's wonderful. Okay. With that, I'll close the public hearing on HJM 6 and open a work session on HJM 6.
Madam Chair, I move HJM 6A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves HJM 6 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And
we have a doctor on the committee?
Yes, we have a doctor on the floor.
Okay. Honored, Madam Chair.
With that, I'll close the work session at HJM 6 and go away. Oh, yeah, the vote count. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
I said, is there any opposition?
Aye.
You did.
I did.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Yeah, for the record, you asked if there was any opposition, but then you didn't announce it, so.
Yes.
Okay.
It's all
all
good.
Right. Okay.
It's all good.
All right, so now let's officially close the work session on HJM 6A and go back to House Bill 2930 that is still open. And the people that can come forward are Laura Jensen, Patty O'Sullivan, and then Christina, is it Cowgill?
Yeah. You want me to go? For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here today to support House Bill 2930. We met with the proponents actually prior to session and worked out some stuff and then worked out some amendments once we saw the bill dropped. The bill, and actually Representative Kenny Geyer did a great overview of the bill, but I just wanted to reiterate that it doesn't require a hospital to privilege a nurse midwife, nurse practitioner. But if you do, then you have to give them admitting privileges, and they are to be on the staff and have voting rights just like any other medical staff member. I had a telephone conversation with our public policy committee of the association, and they overwhelmingly agreed to support it. They wanted to make it very clear, and we've made it very clear, that once this happens, they are treated just like any other medical staff. So if a family practitioner was disciplined for some reason and had to have a double signer, and let's say a nurse practitioner midwife was disciplined for the same reason, they might need to have 2 signatures for admitting. But they will be treated no differently than any other medical staff, so no more privileges, no less privileges, if they are privileged for that hospital. And I believe almost all our hospitals already do this. There's just a few that don't.
Thank you.
So if you have any questions.
Well, let's finish the panel.
Sure.
Thanks. Chair Mama Sanderson and members of the Senate Committee on Healthcare. For the record, my name is Laura Jensen, and I live in Southeast Portland in Oregon. I'm a certified nurse midwife and a nurse midwife nurse practitioner licensed here in the state of Oregon. And just to be to clarify exactly what a CNM is, a certified nurse midwife is a registered nurse and has a master's degree from an accredited graduate school who has passed national board exams and is certified for the American Midwifery Certification Board. In Oregon, in 2013, nurse midwives attended 18% of all births. And 97%, as Representative Kenny Geyer mentioned, of those births were in a hospital setting. And this is why this particular hospital privileging bill is critical. Limitations on access to hospitals prevent nurse midwives from being able to practice what we've been trained to do. The bill aims to increase access to health care for women and to ensure continuity of care, and the bill will hopefully decrease liability for physicians. HB 2930A has the two main parts that we already spoke about, the admitting privileges and then the membership on medical staff with voting rights. No more, no fewer rights. And the changes in this HB 2930A, they won't be new for some hospitals, including the hospital where I work. I have admitting privileges. And this is really common practice at OHSU, where I care for women. I also have membership on medical staff with voting rights. And as just kind of to go through the support, a letter has been submitted for the record by physician Mike Bonazzola, and he's the chair of the Credentials Committee at Oregon Health and Science University. And he's submitted that letter in support of the bill. The Oregon chapter of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, so Oregon ACOG and National ACOG, and there are sort of closest physician colleagues. They support our bill both at a state and federal level. And Dr. Marguerite Cohen has submitted a letter on behalf of ACOG in support. And then my own professional organization, obviously the American College of Nurse Midwives, supports the bill. The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and we're very excited to say that the bill passed unanimously, 59-0, out of the House. On a federal level, CMS has written that it encourages medical staff and hospitals to take advantage of the expertise and skills of non-physician practitioners when making recommendations and appointments to medical staff, and defers to state law when regarding this issue. So HB 2930A would be consistent with federal body statements on the matter of hospital privileging and medical staff membership. And to sum it up, having access to high quality, cost-effective care is important for the women and families of Oregon. Midwives have a long tradition of working in underserved areas, including in rural settings. Midwives have been shown to have low rates of interventions in labor and birth, with excellent outcomes and high patient satisfaction. And with Medicaid covering over 40% of births in the state, having nurse midwifery care available to all women can be an important aspect to help contain costs for the state while still ensuring the health and promoting the well-being of Oregon women and babies. HB 2930A will help Oregon to achieve the triple aim of improving the health of the population, enhancing the patient experience and outcomes, and reducing per capita cost of care for the benefit of our communities. And thank you for your time and support.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christina Cowgill, and I am wearing a different hat than some of you know me by. So today I am representing the Board of Nursing as their advanced practice policy analyst, filling in for the permanent policy analyst while she's on military leave. And just for clarification, the Board of Nursing is neutral on this bill, but we did provide informational testimony in the House, so I was asked to be here today. And I think the proponents of the bill, along with Representative Kenny Geyer, have done an excellent job describing the intent of the bill. And the only thing that I would want to add is that APRNs, which nurse midwives are, advanced practice registered nurses, are licensed independent providers of health care. And it is well within their scope and expertise to be considered alongside physicians and dentists for admitting privileges within the hospitals. And the IOM, which is the Institute of Medicine, the Federal Trade Commission, and the National Governors Association report have found no concerns in regards to the quality or safety of this practice. I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I My daughter was delivered by Legacy Nurse Midwives Practice, and I absolutely will support the bill. I couldn't think higher of this bill. It does beg a question, though, and Patty, maybe you can help me with this, is how do hospitals decide who gets admitting privileges and who doesn't? What physician gets admitting privileges, what doesn't, what nurse practitioner does and what doesn't, what CNM does and doesn't?
Chairman Anderson, Senator Shields, you know, I'm not an expert on that, but just in a general answer to your question, and I can get you more information, they have bylaws of each hospital, and first of all, you go by the rules and the bylaws. Those bylaws are made up of the medical staff, and so some of that is contained in there. So, for instance, OHSU would have in their bylaws right now that nurse practitioner midwives also get admitting privileges and voting rights, and then Hospital X might have, well, they can be privileged to deliver here and serve their client, but if they're on the admitting side, they can't have admitting privileges, so it would have to be co-signed by a doctor. So each hospital has their own. Now, on a more personal level, who gets privilege for each hospital? That's all done through the credentialing. And, you know, you have to have a certain background. You have to have no complaints. So they do like a, you know, criminal background, but they do more than that. Or do you have the right certificates and what, and do you have the right authorities to practice doing what? And then your privileging is wrapped up around that. Is that vague enough for you?
I think so. But, I mean, my concern is that mm-hmm. a hospital might decide, you know, we just like doctors, and so we're going to give doctors admitting privileges, but we're not going to give nurse practitioners who are doing primary care admitting privileges. Does that happen?
Senator Shields, yes, it does. It actually does. I heard on this phone call I had that there is a hospital that actually does not allow primary care doctors to deliver babies in their hospital. They actually do allow nurse practitioners to. But in my understanding, because it seemed very strange to me, but, and I haven't confirmed this, this was a telephone call thing, what I understood was there was an overabundance of OBGYNs in that community, and they wanted to do the delivering. So if you, and so I think, you know, I think there's some obvious things where they open it up and everybody's fine, come on through the doors. And then I think maybe in this in the middle-sized communities, there's some political shifting like there is anywhere else. And then in the small communities, you know, they're very supportive of the nurse practitioner midwives because they can't always get OBGYNs or even family physicians. So I really think it's by geographic area, culture of that community, culture of that hospital.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, it just kind of begs the question that this might require some more attention in future legislatures, just to make sure that it's fair, because the bulk of our hospitals are nonprofit, and they should be a fair process for any provider to get.
And Senator Shields, we're actually seeing that. I mean, we are, you know, sometimes you have to take baby steps, and not shove things down people's throats. I'm very supportive on behalf of the association of this bill, and we actually have a bill that we introduced allowing nurse practitioners to work in our acute care psych units and emergency rooms on folks with mental illness. We're introducing that and allowing them because right now they actually do the work, and you guys actually passed that bill. It was Senate Bill 840. And Senator Bates came and talked about how sometimes he gets called in the middle of the night just to sign something, and he's never seen the patient. So I think it's coming, and it's coming a little bit maybe slower than you would like, but I think that the culture of hospitals as any businesses, some areas are a little slower to move than others, but the main big hospitals in the metro area all do this stuff already, and it's just bringing the others along. So I appreciate what you're saying, and I think you're right. There will be more of this in the future.
Yeah, and I don't want to get in the way of this bill, so I'll keep it at that.
Thank you very much.
I really support the bill, and look forward to it passing.
Great. Thank you.
Great. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2930 and open a work session on House Bill 2930.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2938 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2930 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Sangheiler?
Aye.
Senator Knoll?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
General
Sanders? Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Shields will be carrying the bill. That, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2930. And colleagues, there are a couple of things I need to just put on the record. We had Senate Bill 891 that didn't get out of committee, and I meant to put on the record that there'll be a work group, and that'll include the hospitals and carriers, mainly hospitals and carriers, and Steiner Hayward's office will be working with it as well as committee staff. All right, and then the other thing is on House Bill 2419 from the president of Steve Brown from the Oregon Association of the Deaf had testimony for House Bill 2419. Which we had heard last week, and I wanted to make sure that their testimony, that they thought it was today, correct? Well, anyway, they need to have their testimony entered into the record. Okay. With that, I will open, is this the one next thing? House Bill 2296, Zena.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2296 changes the name of the Board of Body Art Practitioners to the Board of Electrologists and Body Art Practitioners. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. Jamie Bloom, Sheila Aaron, and Deborah Ludwig.
You'll go in first.
Please proceed.
Chairman Anderson and Senator Cruz, thank you so much, and committee members for letting us be here today. I am Deborah Ludwig. I'm from Winchester Bay, Oregon, so I came a long way for this today. And I'm representing the Oregon Association of Licensed Electrologists. I just recently became past president. As you can see by our letter here, I was president at the time I signed this. So we have our president with us as well. And we're just asking for your support on this House Bill 2296. Just a very brief overview. In 1987, we had a advisory board. It was strictly for electrologists. That was back in 1987. And what happened, it's probably been 3 years ago or so, they started licensing tattooists and body piercers and dermal scarification individuals, which we were asked to become one board. Well, in that process, they changed the name of our board to the Body Art Practitioners Board, BAP. We've had a unanimous decision at the House of Representatives level to go ahead with this. And so we're hoping that we can also have your support. There will not be any fiscal impact. It's simply a name change, and it's recognition for our profession. Most states in the union, when you try to look up electrologists, they have their own boards already named with the electrologist as part of their board. So that's all we're asking for today. And I'm going to let the other girls talk a little bit.
Thank you.
Senator Muncy Anderson and Senator Cruz, members of the committee. I'm Sheila Ahern. I'm the legislative chairman of the OALE, and I've been an electrologist in downtown Portland for 38 years and live in North Portland in Senator Shields' district. And I'm here to add on a little bit. Debbie has said our Our group was originally licensed a long time ago, lost licensure for about 10 years, and gained it back in about 1988 and formed an advisory council for electrologists. So it was, and it was our group alone. And then as tattooists needed licensing, we needed similar things of oversight in terms of sanitation, continuing education, inspections. They joined our group. And then just about 3 years ago, the piercing program needed full licensure, and it seemed like a good fit as well. And it spread out to be an entire board then representing that many people at all. So when it was announced, it had a working name, and we objected at the time because we didn't seem like we fit. We never thought of ourselves as body artists, but it needed to be done, and so we didn't raise a fuss then, but we've lived with it for a while, and we really do feel that the name is not only misrepresenting of our profession, it also misleads the public, because they can't tell that electrologists are licensed when you look at the term body art, because their name is just not out there. And in my written testimony, which you might have seen, that if a person were to look up body art, say in Wikipedia or in a dictionary, you see all kinds of things, not only, you know, the piercing and tattooing that the board covers, but other things as well. But you'll never find electrolysis in the test, because we remove hair, and they're applying artwork or metal or what, you know, to the body. So we would really like to see it changed. And we made a special request to the webmaster for the state website to put the keyword electrolysis in. I think he maybe put electrolysis and electrologist. So you can find us now through the state website. But until he did that, you couldn't tell that we were a regulated body. And so, you know, I think we shouldn't have to make all these extra steps. And many people looking at other search engines may not find us unless we're our name is in that title. We had, so the general public would not identify us if they just saw body art. Again, we were put in this category because we do alter the structure of the skin. So there was a very loose connection with that, and that's how we kind of got lumped in together. But we really do feel that that we would like to have our name as identified. We'd like to have our identity back.
Thank you. Senator Anderson, Senator Cruz, and the committee. My name is Jamie Bloom. I live in South Portland, Southwest Portland. I've been working in downtown Portland for the last, I think, 27 years. I was on the advisory, Oregon Licensing Agency 4 years. When this went down, what happened is the name became so long, and they just squashed it. Most people, electrologist, again, as Sheila had said, does not do body art. We are part of the health profession, and we need our name back into electrology so people can find us, know that we're licensed, know that we are regulated. And I am now the president of the OALE again. And we really would like your support. We had a meeting last year and this year, and we have a little bit over 50% of all electrologists in Oregon, members of the OALE. They're really upset that the name was changed and would like to see electrolysis put into the name of the statue again.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Questions for this panel? All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2296 and open a work session on House Bill 2296.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2296 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2296 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Harris?
Aye.
Senator Kelly?
Excused.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Cruz, would you carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. Senator Cruz will carry the bill. I will close the work session on House Bill 2296 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2880.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2880 specifies that a physician assistant may not practice fluoroscopy on a person unless they hold a certificate issued by the Board of Medical Imaging. It requires the physician assistant to complete 80 hours of didactic and clinical training and pass the examination for certification. It modifies the supervising physician requirements and directs the Board of Medical Imaging to issue the certificate. It becomes operative January 1st, 2016. There is no amendment and no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Great. Elizabeth Remley, Susan, is it Platinum Hopkins, and Judah Gold. Okay, we'll have Elizabeth and Judah Gold Maxwell?
Markell.
Testify first, and then Susan, you can come up too.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee on this lovely day. My name's Judah Gold Markell. I'm a physician assistant, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2880. I've worked at Legacy Health for the past 11 years in the field of vascular surgery and trauma surgery. Initially, we looked into changing the laws regarding the use of fluoroscopy about 3 to 4 years ago, just so that we're all clear. Fluoroscopy is a imaging modality using ionizing radiation, particularly in the hospital setting. Over the past several years, we've been working and gaining consensus on how these changes would be implemented and applied. The use of fluoroscopy and minimally invasive interventions is the future of medicine and essential to allow physician assistants to continue to thrive in the fields that utilize this technology. I would like to thank the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging for working with us and the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants to develop House Bill 2880. The Board of Medical Imaging deliberated thoughtfully on this issue, convened multiple work groups with multiple stakeholders, and ultimately voted to approve a proposal that would represent a reasonable compromise amongst all of the entities involved. 32 states currently allow PAs to practice fluoroscopy. 22 of these states simply have no requirements or regulations for PAs to practice fluoroscopy. With House Bill 2880, Oregon would join 12 other states that have the most rigorous requirements for PAs to practice fluoroscopy. House Bill 2880 creates a certification process through the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging. The certification process includes three important components. First, the education. In order to obtain a fluoroscopy certificate from OBMI, a PA must complete 80 hours of clinical and didactic training as outlined by the Fluoroscopy Education Framework for the Physician Assistant. This framework is a national standard created through the collaboration of the American Association of Physician Assistants and the American Society of Radiation Technologists. The education component includes operation safety, important information about radiation biology, and exposure limits. Second, the exam. The PA must then pass the exam developed by the same national framework. And then third, a fee. The Board of Medical Imaging will charge a fee to cover the cost of processing the certificate application. Once the PA obtains a certificate to practice fluoroscopy, that certificate also goes on file at the Oregon Medical Board, which licenses PAs. A supervising physician may only delegate fluoroscopy procedures to PAs who have a certificate. When a PA is practicing fluoroscopy, a radiation technologist or physician must also be in the room, and the PA's supervising physician must be available in the building to assist in an emergency. I am pleased with House Bill 2880 and the collaborative effort it took to craft this legislation. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you, and if you have any questions, please, I'm here.
Let's hear the panel, and then...
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. And I want to thank Judah for all the work that he's done to bring this issue forward to you. We've spent about 2 years working on this bill. We worked with the Board of Medical Imaging, the Medical Association, and in a work group with several radiation techs to come up with this compromise. As Judah said, and I will clarify, his math is wrong because I wrote it wrong. There are 22 states that allow PAs to do fluoroscopy. 20 of those states don't have this rigorous of a requirement, and 12 of them do. So we would be joining those 12 states with very rigorous requirements. The certificate would go on the board, on file at the medical board before a supervising physician would be allowed to delegate this procedure to a physician assistant. Right now, the problem right now is that statute prohibits a PA from actually pressing the pedal on the machine. They actually can do every other part of the procedure. And so this would just release that pinch point in statute so that a PA can do the whole thing and there isn't a potential for any kind of delay or extra exposure for the patient to this radiation, because there doesn't have to be verbal communication between two people. It does require that somebody be in the room with the physician assistant, either their supervising radiologist or a radiation tech. So we're not eliminating the amount of expertise that's required to be in the room by doing this, but we are allowing the PA to do the entire procedure on their own. And it does require that the supervising physician be in the building and available to assist in the case of an emergency. So that's the gist of the bill, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you for your time.
Okay, let's hear from Susan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am here representing the Oregon Society of Radiologic Technologists and expressing their reasons for opposition to this bill.
And state your name.
I'm sorry. My name is Susan Putnam Hopkins. I'm a practicing radiographer for over 27 years and have been two-time past president of the OSRT. Radiation safety and protection of patients by imaging professionals are professional standards and essential skills learned throughout our years of education and training. A typical educational program for radiographers includes several thousand hours of clinical education where these skills are learned and practiced. All students are closely observed for 2 years and are not deemed competent until if they fail to perfect those skills. The proposed training provided by the American Society of Radiologic Technologists, not radiation technologists, is only 40 hours of clinical and 40 didactic, which is not adequate for these skills to be presented and perfected and learned. We are also concerned about the training process and how that will be conducted. Because fluoroscopy procedures result in a higher level of radiation exposure, the skill of the operator is essential for reducing the exposure as much as possible. Radiologist assistants are trained beyond the level of the physician assistant in all aspects of imaging and should be the ones performing fluoroscopy procedures. They have trained extensively with the radiologist's supervision and are very skilled in knowing how to image and reduce patient exposure. As with physician assistants, the reimbursement for radiologist assistants is 85% of what the physician would be reimbursed. Please consider these important issues before making this decision.
Thank you. Question from you two. She was saying, how would the training be conducted? I think you might have mentioned that, but how would the
There is a national standard that has been developed in collaboration between the AAPA and also the American Society of Radiation Technologists. It's a didactic portion, and then also a hands-on portion as well. It's as mentioned, 80 hours of additional training beyond what we already have, as we already get some in school already. So, and then to complete it, there's also an exam that must be taken at the end of that.
Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee, both the course curriculum, as far as on the ground training and the book part of it is set forth by this national standard, and we would be working with the Oregon Board of Medical Imaging to decide and rule how to document those things.
Okay, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Ms. Hopkins, help me. I'm really not trying to be confrontational. I don't understand. We've heard testimony that the Board of Radiology Technologists participated in developing these training standards. Are you testifying on behalf of your society? Because if your board's participating...
On my society.
On your society.
Itself,
okay.
Yes.
And do you have evidence from the other states that there has been patient harm that's been caused by physician assistants having these privileges?
I do not have that at this time, but I could look into it and be sure to email it to you.
Okay. Could you? Do
there,
others?
There is none.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Further discussion?
If I could just say that the name of the American Society of Radiologic Technologists, there's no such thing as radiation technologists.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2880. And colleagues, we could go into work session if we wanted to. All right. I will open a work session on House Bill 2880.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2888 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2888 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator
excused.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Steyer-Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Mostert?
Aye. Motion carries, and I will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2880. And
Chair, if I could just say one thing. I really would like to commend the physician assistants for their diligence in working this bill. Ms. Remley, I'm commending you. You might not want to walk out of the room. I just wanted to say I was commending the physician assistants for the work that you did in preparing for this and making sure that, you know, in Oregon we would be following these strictest standards for patient protection and to get it to a place where this is clearly a patient safety-oriented bill, and we really appreciate that because too often we get in here and it's a matter of turf battles, as we sort of heard, unfortunately. And I don't see this as a turf battle. I see this as an access issue and as a patient safety issue, and I think it's a good bill. And I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Okay. Just a minute here. I got to write them down. Okay. All right. So I'll open public hearing on House Bill 2305A.
Zena. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2305A allows individuals who complete a polysomnographic program that combines education and training to apply for the polysomnographic technologist license. It clarifies that an individual that has met the required education and training and who has obtained and maintained the nationally recognized credential meets the prerequisites for licensure by the Respiratory Therapist and Polysomnographic Technologist Licensing Board. There is a dash A4 amendment which specifies the date of March 1st, 2013. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Great. We have, let's start with, is it Janice White, Erica Kennett, and Paul Cosgrove? And then rounding it up will be Jessica Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health, and I'll just give a brief introduction, and then following the testimony of Ms. White and Ms. Kennett, I'll be glad to explain the purpose of the amendment. We appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill. As you know, we did a good deal of work on the House side and amended the bill to address some concerns and make sure it was very clear what we were trying to do, which is to allow polysomnographic technologists who have the nationally recognized certification to become more easily licensed in Oregon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. White.
Hi. My name is Janice White, but I go by Jan. Thank you. I work for Legacy Health. I'm the manager of the Sleep Disorder Center at Legacy Good Samaritan Hospital. Thank you, for Madam Chair, for hearing us today. First of all, the most important thing that I want to get across here is that we've met with the board on several occasions, and we believe that there's still a misconception. And I want to clear that misconception up. We are not discounting the value of education and experience combined. We are asking Oregon to recognize a combination of education and experience that is recognized by the board of the registered polysomnographic technologists, which is our national gold standard and credentialing body. The things that have developed are difficulties in hiring within our profession. It is very difficult at this point to hire anybody from out of state. Within our state, we certainly have experienced people, but we have not had excessive applications coming from those experienced people within the state. And those people outside of the state who do have extensive experience are not able to get licensed within our state. The average time to fill vacancies at Legacy Health in the sleep disorder centers is about 98 days at this point. Right now, the applications that we receive are a combination of respiratory therapists who are all new grads, almost all brand new grads with no sleep experience. And within the education and training for respiratory care practitioners in the schools, they get approximately 6 to 12 hours of training in polysom in sleep, which is does not an experienced polysom tech make. Couple of examples of some applicants that we have had and were very qualified applicants and unable to hire. At our Legacy Mount Hood facility, we had an applicant who was coming to us from Arizona, actively practicing in a sleep disorder center in Arizona, had also previously practiced in California. He had 15 years of experience in the field. He was registered with the National Board, the Board of Polysomnography Technology, registered polysomnography technologist, I'm sorry. He was not able to be hired into our system because he had not graduated from a KHEP accredited program. He was, however, willing at his very own expense to go ahead and enroll in an A-STEP program, which is a self-driven program. It is accredited. The A-STEP program is an American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and it is accredited sleep technology education program. He was willing to do that himself. However, even with that, he would have had to come into our organization into a lab, a two-bed lab, and would have had to have 18 months of indirect supervision, which means on-site supervision, which means that his supervisor would have needed to be there with him within the building for 18 months, and here's somebody who had 15 years of experience and had been registered. A second applicant that we had, I was at Good Samaritan, I was attempting to hire a clinical supervisor for my lab, and I had several applicants that were not qualified, and I had an applicant who was extremely qualified. She was coming from one of our southern states, and she had 12 years of experience. She was a registered polysomnographic technologist. She also had had supervisory experience, and she attempted to acquire a license in the state of Oregon, and again, because of her length of time of experience, she had not attended a KHEP program, as the KHEP programs have only been around since 2006, and she was in the field far before that. And so she was unable to successfully acquire a license and just gave up her fight. She also was willing to, at her own expense, do one of the A-STEP programs. Again, she would have, if she had finished that and had come to our organization, she would have had to have 18 months of supervision, and thus a position, a clinical supervisor who is being supervised by subordinates, which didn't make sense. She chose not to pursue a license in Oregon any further. Again, it's important, I think, to know that the programs for the KHEP program have only been around since 2006. In the entire country, there are only 42 programs, and only two of those are in the state of Oregon. So in conclusion, I would like to thank you for hearing our case and also ask you to please, on the behalf of Legacy and the field of polysomnography, consider House Bill 2305 in opening the options for a combination of education and experience in acquiring the license for the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Let's finish the panel and then open it up for questions.
Good afternoon. My name is Erica Kennett, and I'm the clinical supervisor of the Sleep Disorder Center at Legacy Good Samaritan's Medical Center. And I'd like to speak a bit to my own experience getting licensed as a polysomnographic technologist in Oregon. I entered the polysomnography field in 2007 in Ohio through a combined education and experience program that is recognized by the state of Oregon. It was one of those KHEP programs. In 2012, I finished my master's in health administration and began a nationwide job search, eventually finding the perfect fit with Legacy in Portland and I prepared to move my family across the country. As I initiated the application for an Oregon polysomnography license, I discovered that the Oregon administrative rules require our national credentialing exam, the RPSGT exam, to have been passed in the previous 2 years. I had been registered for 5 years and, in fact, had just submitted all of my continuing education credits to the Board of Registered Polysomnographic Technologists and renewed my credential, which is required of all RPSGTs every 5 years. So I called the Oregon Health Licensing Office to see if this would be sufficient. I was told that by the wording of the current administrative rules that it would not, and I had, in effect, held my credential too long to qualify for licensure without retaking this $450 exam. Next, I contacted the BRPT, the Board of Registered Polysomnographic Technologists, to arrange to retake this exam and found out that they don't, or at that time, didn't allow current credential holders to retake it. I was kind of in a bind. Eventually, the Oregon Health Licensing Office had to contact the BRPT directly, explain the situation, and they've since made a specific exemption just for techs in Oregon seeking licensure to be able to retake the exam. Additionally, due to the processing time of getting signed up for that, I wasn't able to retake this exam until after I was already in Oregon, which meant Legacy could only make a contingent offer until I had received my license. So I effectively moved my family 2,400 miles across the country on a contingent offer and on my confidence that I could repass that exam again. As you can imagine, this was incredibly stressful, time-consuming, and not to mention costly. However, I'm still one of the lucky ones. The polysomnography education program I went through did happen to be one that Oregon recognizes for licensure. If I had started in the field before 2006 and had gone through one of the longer-standing education programs that the BRPT recognizes, I would have been ineligible for a permanent license. The current rules prevent the people of Oregon from benefiting from the expertise of the most experienced technologists in the field. They're also inconsistent with national standards by recognizing just the most recent of numerous accredited and respected education programs that are recognized by our gold standard national credentialing body. I strongly support the passage of House Bill 2305 to allow educated, experienced techs to work in Oregon, and I also thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I neglected to say one thing, if I may add. Exhibit number 23, it was part of the record on the House side, lists a number of other institutions beyond Legacy or in support of this bill, including Oregon Health Science University, the Oregon Association of Hospitals Health Systems, Portland Adventist, Providence, and Salem Health. But what I also wanted to mention is the Health Licensing Office, and Ms. Mercer, of course, is in the room, has been extraordinarily helpful in helping us try to figure out how to craft a solution to this problem. The problem has not been by any means the willingness of the office to work with us to try to find a solution. And the reason it's a problem, particularly in Oregon, is we're one of the few states, there are only 14 plus the District of Columbia, that have licensing of these kinds of professionals. So it's a difficulty for people who are experienced in another state but not licensed by the other state because the other state doesn't have a licensing mechanism to come into Oregon. So we appreciate your time. Happy to answer questions.
Question? Yes.
Can I just make a comment really quickly? I don't know if people understand why this is really important. Polysomnographers are critical to understanding sleep disorders, and sleep disorders are becoming increasingly prevalent, and we know that sleep disorders and insufficient adequate sleep contribute to all sorts of major health problems, and so having an adequate supply of polysomnographers in this state is absolutely critical to helping prevent obesity, hypertension, heart disease. I could go on for a really long time. And so I think this is a really important bill, and I'm very pleased that you've brought it forward. Thank you.
Great. Any other questions?
Let's pass it.
All right. Thank you very much, Jessica Adamson. And Holly, do you want to just come up to say?
Madam Chair, I also said I would explain what the reason for the amendment. The amendment is kind of an interesting one in that it says that the standards by which the National Board, the combined education and training, are the standards that the National Board adopted on March 1st, 2013. Just to make the record clear, those are the current standards. But when we were trying to decide which date to refer to, it was felt that that was the most likely date that a future candidate would be able to find what are the standards that the National Board had at this time, is by referring to the date on which the National Board adopted those standards of education and training. So that's why we picked March 1st, 2013.
So the amendment does?
The amendment does that. It makes that the standards that the applicants have to comply with are the standards for the National Board in effect as of on and after March 1st, 2013, which is the current standards that the National Board has. That's the date that they adopted them. We checked this with Legislative Council. Dexter Johnson agreed we could pick any date that was the easiest date for applicants to find that is either now or prior to now. And so that's why we picked March 1st, 2013.
So I'm a little confused. So someone that could, that say was in the example of yours, having taken, had 12 years or 15 years of experience, I'm not sure the nexus between them and the date March 1st, 2013.
If the, Madam Chair, if the candidate has met the experience and training standards in effect as of March 1st,
oh, I see. Okay.
Regardless of when they took that, and that's an important distinction. We're not trying to make this based on when they took it. We're talking about them meeting the national certification standards, getting the national credential, okay, and keeping it active. That's the gold standard. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. We just very quickly want to add our voice in support of this bill and appreciate our colleagues at Legacy for doing yeoman's work to try and help deal with what is a real narrow but serious problem in terms of hiring the best and brightest and bringing them to this state to practice in a very important field of medicine. We face many of the same challenges in hiring qualified folks to come to Oregon and struggling to get them through the licensing process. So we have been supportive all the way along as this has followed a regulatory trajectory and now into the legislative one, and urge this committee to move this bill with the amendment forward. Thank you.
Right. Okay. And Holly, do you have any words to say on the bill?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm Holly Mercer. I'm the Director of the Health Licensing Office. I do have to say that the proponents of this bill went through every administrative rulemaking possibility that they could to change these requirements by rule. The board did not agree at the time, and they decided to go into legislative action. And we've worked with the proponents, and we think we've landed on a good compromise. So we are neutral, of course, on the bill, but we appreciate their patience with
Thank
us.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right. Thank you very much. And you don't have any opposition to the amendment that's being proposed. Okay. All right. Colleagues, we don't have the paperwork since we have an amendment.
Yeah, we do.
Oh, we do? On the amendment? Okay, well, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2305 and open a work session on House Bill 2305.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the A4 amendment to House Bill 2305A.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the A4 amendments into House Bill 2305. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2305A as amended by the -4 A4 amendments to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2305 with its -A4 amendment to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye, motion carries. I'll carry the bill and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2305. And we, any announcements? We're adjourned.
All right.
I love efficiency.